is Angle of View. Today is August 25th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Thank you all for finding a way to survive my six-week absence, and greetings from Toronto, Ontario, Canada, where I will be spending at least the next 4 years while my amazing wife completes her PhD program in English. That's the big thing I spent the past 5 months arranging, at the expense of nearly all my free time, as well as a great deal of the unfree time that I used to put toward personal projects such as this show. It is with gratitude that I accept X-Ray's offer to keep up Angle of View from here, and while I won't indulge in the embarrassing self-flattery of calling myself an international correspondent, I will enjoy the fact that Toronto theaters screen a lot of movies that Portland theaters get much later or not at all. It will still be a few weeks before I can get myself back into a steady rhythm of movie-going and writing. The contents of our apartment are still about 70% cardboard by volume. And then I will have to complete my Spielberg ranking project, which was something I originally thought up because it seemed easier than keeping up with new releases, and now has become its own albatross. But as it happens, I was able to steal a little time over the course of my hiatus to see a couple of major new releases, and I think those will do a nice job filling up an episode, so let's set that goal for this week, and we'll deal with the future when we get there. Christopher Nolan is now officially a tragic figure, so at least there can be one thing about his laughable crack at the Odyssey that feels Greek. His favorite thing in the world, the only thing he respects, is size. Yet he completely misunderstands it. He mistakes volume for weight. His movies are something different from spectacles, by which I mean something lesser. They are purely formal, perfectly self-involved exercises in the big and important image, untethered to the dramatic arts. When he gets a good performance, as he does here from John Leguizamo, it's an accident. He's like an architect who designs buildings so grand and imposing that they would be visible from space, but that have no entrances. In the story of how our culture prepared the ground for its own replacement by pure technology barf, this kind of image, the kind that can only stand on its own and for itself, plays a major role, and indeed a disproportionate percentage of the AI-generated major movie simulacra that I've been unfortunate enough to see have looked like Nolan. Good on him for speaking out against the tech, but he has served it a lot of food. It is his image that became the template for emulation, precisely because it has no dimensions to emulate. Even along the single thin line of their operation, Nolan's movies trip themselves up constantly, and none more than this one. No story can feel important if every human element in it is ridiculous, and he continues to have no knowledge or curiosity about human relationships. He has never achieved a grasp of the most basic and obvious dramatic verities, the kind that become aesthetic verities by how central and crucial they are, like that you can't get invested in a situation without being invested in the people who are in the situation, and you can only build up characters if you let your actors work, and you can't get power out of an actor unless you let them breathe and find rhythms. And you can't give a scene gravity if you cut every half second, and why would anyone shoot a 3-hour movie in IMAX if its entire visual conception was smother the actors in close-up and then cut away from them as fast as possible? But as might be expected of a Best Picture and Best Director winner, Nolan just shrugs about these things and then announces he's going to take on The Odyssey. And in his hands, it becomes the biggest, definitely the loudest, movie of the year, full of enormous famous faces and extraordinary feats of scale for scale's sake, and bereft of human beings. Everything in the movie stands on a separate set of legs. It has no bearings. It is brimming with Homer's creatures and showcases hundreds of bodies in stages of transformation, suffering, and death, yet not a single thing that the movie has to show you gets anywhere near the sensual, not even in Hades. It's all rote effects showcase. The sirens are good for about 4 minutes of bad comedy. Penelope, a rudderless Anne Hathaway, is a frustrated modern divorcee. The climax is pure and unironic Schwarzenegger. The Cyclops seems to exist purely so that we can hear what the sound team cooked up for his howl of pain when he suffers his wound. And 10 seconds later, not even that matters anymore. We're on to the next thing, as we always are with Nolan, before we can get a chance to process the last one. This story of a miserable wait is hurried through at such a juvenile ADHD pace that no feeling of any kind can pile up. You feel like you're being dragged around by a kid arriving at Disneyland an hour before closing. Yet this hyper-cranking makes the movie feel a good 40 minutes longer than it is. His screenplay took Emily Wilson's translation past vulgarity into sap. The dialogue is so banal and blanched and sanitary that there is no longer a trace of poetry in the poem. His arch-rationalism robs the story of its divine and magical aspects. He opens the film with a card that reads, "In a time of apparent magic, emphasis mine," and you can practically see his teeth gritted over that one concession. It's got all the hollowness and the imposed, vapid, anodyne modern morality of a 50s, 60s Hollywood biblical slash antiquity epic. Penelope is mortified to learn, as an adult, that her culture performs human sacrifices. Odysseus gets his screaming soldiers inside the walls of Troy and is then shocked and heartbroken when they begin helping themselves to rape and slaughter. Violation of Xenia, the Greek hospitality law, becomes the towering metaphor for all modern warmongering, and on it goes with the liberal chicken feed. But it's all joined to an overkinetic visual insecurity that is stinkingly contemporary, and that has now become Nolan's personal calling card. He probably would have been a very good director of music videos. Let's now make a hard turn from our least to our most self-aware director. Teenage Sex and Death at Camp Miasma is at once the safest and the most ambitious movie that Jane Schoenbrunn could have chosen to make at this pivotal moment in their career, and this is only the outermost of its contradictions. Like Schoenbrunn's first two movies, Camp Miasma is another therapeutic exercise, a purging of the artist's own anxieties about having gotten so involved in movies and television and internet lore during their formative years that their human development processes got routed through a network of media references, and the ensuing deeper fear that this might have left them unable to engage with the basics of human experience outside that mediatized context. The clear difference is that this time, the personal anxieties under investigation are about the artist's sexuality instead of their gender, but there is another difference between Camp Miasma and Schoenbrunn's earlier work that is more striking and happier. Their previous movie, I Saw the TV Glow, had a central contradiction and was unraveled by it. In that film, the TV show at the center of the story, the show that quickened the trans awareness of both main characters when they were in high school, was forced to serve double duty as two opposed metaphors. It was both the childhood fantasy world that they were supposed to leave behind as they strode into their empowered adult lives, and the literal place that they were supposed to return to and live in forever. In other words, it was both the road to gender identity fulfillment and the destination. In Camp Miasma, the central contradiction is that Chris, the queer filmmaker main character whose work concerns queer desire and whose own queer sexual awakening was delivered by horror movies, cannot achieve orgasm. She must learn over the course of the film to enjoy sexual gratification so that she can experience human connection, as well as bring her ideas about sex home to her body. And the way she manages this from inside the tangle of horror movie tropes that have nested in that part of her brain is to give over to them. Chris liberates her sexuality from the tunnel of media by going deeper in, and Schoenbrunn, by extension, is working through their own issues as a media-steeped queer movie maker by going deeper into movies about media, in the process unearthing riches much more valuable than the kind of cleverness at which most navel-gazing terminates. Any filmmaker can train a lens on their own insecurities, and these days, any filmmaker can climb up one level of perspective so that they can watch them watching themselves. Charlie Kaufman is only the most prestigious one to make a career out of it in this century. But where he and his ilk typically locate and label and stop, Schoenbrunn keeps going to the inside of the fears underneath: loneliness, disembodiment, feeling like a stranger to oneself, and discovers something trembling and sweet at the core of all sexual connection. If the end of the film weren't so moving, we might wonder what it was all for. But in view of the shockingly tender place where we end up, it's difficult not to marvel at what Schoenbrunn has achieved. Instead of busting furiously out of their comfort zone, they have turned it inside out. The contradiction in I Saw the TV Glow was undiscovered and unfortunate, and it draped a shroud of confusion over the film's thematic processes. This time, the contradiction is about a character's confusion, and the film is about this contradiction, and the theme is nothing without it. It is the irritant that Schoenbrunn spends the movie's running time making into a pearl. As the movie opens, Chris, Hannah Einbinder, our protagonist, is traveling under heavy snowfall to the remote Pacific Northwest to meet Billy Presley, Gillian Anderson, the star of the original Camp Miasma movie, hoping to unlock some deeper understanding of the story and its cultural resonance, and hoping also to see for herself the look in Billy's eyes that activated Chris's sexual awareness when she was young. In the world of Schoenbrunn's movie, Camp Miasma was a summer camp slasher franchise along the lines of Friday the 13th, and Chris, a burgeoning filmmaker, has been in talks with a studio to revive it. Actually, it is an understatement to say along the lines. Its killer is considerably more surreal besides containing the gender concerns of Sleepaway Camp, but in every other way, including the typeface used on the poster, Camp Miasma is basically identical to Friday the 13th. Billy Presley, we are told, never appeared in another movie and became a recluse, while her one credit spawned its multiple waves of sequels and eventually became a camp classic, as well as a text for young queer scholars like Chris to analyze and rotate their love-hate relationship with in their minds, the way Sleepaway Camp is in our reality, though Schoenbrunn makes it clear that Sleepaway Camp exists in this reality too. When Chris's car spills into a snowdrift, her GPS announces that she has arrived at her destination, upon which she gets out and discovers that Billy lives at the actual summer camp where the first several films were shot. Billy has run away from Camp Miasma by moving to its center, in the first articulation of the theme. Chris has no overt intention of cajoling Billy into joining the cast of her reboot, but nor can she connect to her on a personal level with anything like ease or comfort, partly because the character Billy played in the original movie is more real to her than the real Billy can ever be, and partly because Billy is so comfortable in her skin that it magnifies Chris's nervous energy by contrast. As their first meeting gets underway, Chris parries Billy's personal questions by giving rehearsed answers about her work, while they eat fried chicken onto which a whole audiovisual network of sexual cues has been transferred. A parodic sensual slow-motion montage puts extra crispy batter crunches and squelching dipping sauces under a microscope and reverb plate. Einbinder looks every bit the young millennial artist who speaks brilliantly and scholastically, which is to say from a safe distance, about queer identity and sexuality, but who has none of the self-possession required to close that distance and inhabit her own ideas. She can only look straight at Billy when making the kind of confident and usually intellectual declaration that she clearly has practiced in conversation and probably in pitches before, as about Hollywood's invasion and commodification of queer art. Whereas when trying to answer any question that cuts deeper than that, her eyes skip around the room and land on her shoes. During this sequence, you can't help but remember how comfortable Chris had appeared alone in her hotel room the previous night, smiling broadly as she watched a gas station DVD of Camp Miasma Part 6 while munching a dozen different kinds of candy and writing desire in her notebook, all caps, double underline. Even before the fried chicken scene, Chris was already in the habit of transferring sexual pleasure onto food, and it's right that it should be the preferred food of children, because she is essentially pre-sexual at 29. And Schoenbrunn has by this time already added another layer to our understanding of the shape of Chris by showing her in phone conversation with her partner Mary, Jasmine Savoy Brown, a bisexual woman with whom she is involved polyamorously, and making it clear that polyamory is just another self-applied label that Chris wears in order to construct a sense of secure identity from the outside in. She and Mary are clearly not emotionally close, and their sex life is fallow. Chris resents Mary's escapades with a mustachioed doofus named Thor, and Einbinder makes it clear that Chris blames herself, her own frigidity, for having driven Mary into Thor's arms. Chris has little to give to anything other than her work, and she has set herself up this way inside her work because connection terrifies her. Billy is shaking her out of all of this in one evening, plying her with fried chicken, weed, proximity to the touchstone of her earliest sexual comprehension, and genuine curiosity about who she is underneath her ideas. Billy gives Chris her first taste of real desire, something in her chest instead of her notebook, and it hits her like both a dare and a threat. We are by now 20 minutes into the movie, and even while we, with the director's encouragement, see Chris as a self-insert and recognize the familiar beats of first-act table setting, we also recognize that we are witnessing the finest characterization work Schoenbrunn has ever done. Looming all the while over these two women and the connection that they begin to form is Little Death, the slasher from Camp Miasma, who in the lore of that series was raised as both a boy and a girl simultaneously and divided their time between the two segregated camps, and in the original film wears an outfit and a style that is split down the middle vertically. The character is literally bisected by the gender binary. After being tormented and eventually drowned in the lake by their fellow campers, Little Death sank to the bottom and would rise once per movie wearing an HVAC ceiling vent over their head to take revenge on that year's campers with a spear. The HVAC ceiling vent helmet, a telescope of concentric squares, becomes the foremost piece of iconography in the movie. It shows up everywhere, its resemblance to an early camera's accordion bellows, unquestionably meant to echo the larger premise that Little Death is always watching, which becomes the vector by which the world of Camp Miasma bleeds through into the world that Chris and Billy are making together as they grow closer all alone at the real camp. As well as the visual illustration of the central idea which Schoenbrunn begins to dig at here, that people who grew up watching cannot know a lived experience separate from ideas of watching. Chris has nurtured academic ideas about Little Death for decades, but never does she or any other character in the movie mention that the name is a term for orgasm, though this will become the crystal center of the movie's theme before the end. As the two women sit together in the camp screening room watching Billy's personal print of the original film, the bleed-through begins in earnest. Almost nothing about the film seems true to the real appearance or conventions of early 80s slasher movies. And when we reach the peak sequence, a heroic one-shot of Little Death shooting upward from the bottom of the lake to spear almost every camper to death in one go, our bafflement turns to fascination. Everything about the sequence is wrong. From the fact that all the teens are killed in a single long massacre instead of being picked off one at a time, to the obvious CGI and the gore, to the POV one-shot technique that focuses on the killer instead of the victims, to the fact that the song playing is Counting Crows A Long December, which came out in 1996 and makes no aesthetic sense anyway. And since Schoenbrunn knows all of this, something extremely odd must be happening to Chris and Billy. Chris begins to get at it when she says, "I must have seen that movie 100 times, but never like this." We know as well as she does that her own intelligence will not be enough to help her figure it out. Billy, from both inside and outside the movie, is teaching Chris how to watch it, and how to watch her, and how to watch herself with new eyes, and not just a single pair of eyes, either. Between the movie's continual, fiercely smart self-commentary, and the sincere and often wonderful surprises that arrive in its third act anyway, there is a great deal about teenage sex and death at Camp Miasma that is rather off-limits in a review. Its abstract successes exist inside the film's own discussion of them, and if I were to celebrate the concrete ones in the kind of detail typical for a movie review, I would undermine the movie's greatest pleasures, which would be doubly tragic in a movie about the rights and the importance of opening oneself to pleasures. But I can safely say that it is sweet and hopeful all the way through to the end, in a way that will feel cleansing to anyone who walked out of I Saw the TV Glow feeling stapled to the floor by despair. That movie's tensions were resolved only in the belief that it is impossible to integrate the psyche of the lonely, media-obsessed child into the healthy behavior patterns of the mature, socialized adult. And Camp Miasma wrings tears from your eyes by firmly insisting that the opposite outcome is equally within reach, that it is not hopeless for the kids who grew up watching, and that you can squeeze even more pleasure out of horror movies and candy if you find someone to share them with. Charlie Kaufman could never. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.